introduce, well, you're probably familiar with neurons, and they're another kind of cell that are found in the brain called glial cells, and you may or may not be familiar with them, so I'll introduce you to that kind of cell and talk about how these two cell types are coupled to each other in networks in the brain and what functions they may play. I'll use numerical simulations to introduce the hypothesis we're interested in investigating and show you some experimental data in an attempt to investigate the same hypothesis and discuss the challenges and advantages that we've come up with about how to use microfluidic devices to probe this problem. I'll show you some quantitative data analysis that we're doing to try to probe neural activity in actual experiments, and then I'll summarize. Okay, so I'm going to start with what are these glial cells that I'm going to talk about. This is sort of a very provocative article or title for an article that was in Scientific American, I guess, a year and a half ago now. And it says, glial cells are the other half of the brain. And it says, mounting evidence suggests that glial cells, overlooked for half a century, may be nearly as critical to thinking and learning as neurons are. Okay? So what are these glial cells? Well, they comprise about 90% of our brain mass, and neurons comprise 10%. Which means also that they're in the same ratio in number in our brain. And they don't support any action potential. So the way neurons communicate with each other is through electrical activity. And glial cells don't have electrical activity, which is part of the reason they are overlooked for so long. But I'm going to show you they do have other activity, actually chemical activity, which can communicate with the neurons. And so now the picture's changing. So the traditional picture of glial cells, which neurobiologists and biologists have known about for a long time, are that they're important in development stages in terms of guiding neurons to make connections, synaptic connections with each other. They're important in making sure we had healthy synapse formation in the brain. And glia, the word glia means glue. And so another role that glia were thought to play was essentially the scaffolding or the mechanical support structure of that on which this neural network lay. Okay? And then the third picture was that they were sort of, I saw the term governesses of neurons, which is a sexist term, but that they are involved in sort of providing nutrients to the neurons and taking waste products away from the neurons. And so they were playing that role also. So all sort of passive supporting roles to neural networks in the brain, and the neural networks were thought to be the active players that were storing all the information and doing whatever our brain does for memory and learning and so forth. Sensing input, right? Making our eyes blink if the light comes in too brightly and so forth. Okay, so now the new picture that started to develop is that not only neurons are important for taking in sensory input and having us as organisms react to it and also functioning and learning and memory, but that these astrocytes, so I'm going to sometimes make a mistake and call glial cells astrocytes because that's another name, same synonym for glial cells. So I put that up there in case I start doing that. I'll confuse you. Okay, so that these glial cells are actually playing a signaling role in the brain. And what has been discovered, because people started using calcium fluorescent dyes to image samples of neurons and glial cells, is that they've noticed that there are waves of chemical concentration, actually waves of calcium, that propagate in these glial cells. And it turns out that these calcium waves are correlated with rises in concentration of neurotransmitters. And these glial cells, I'll show you in a second, are always found in the vicinity of synapses. As I mentioned, they've been known for a long time to be involved in the formation of healthy synaptic connections between neurons. And so they're really starting to be seen as a third part of the communication connection between neurons. And so this term tripartite synapse is starting to come into play in neurobiology. So to give you an example of how these two cells interact with each other, what we're looking at here is an artist's rendition of what's going on at a synapse. Okay, and this is the axon terminal of one neural body, which is somewhere up here, right? And there's some long wire, which is the axon, which connects the body to some other region in space. And an electrical exit signal will propagate down this axon from one neuron body. Right? When it reaches the end of it, it will cause the secretion or dumping of chemicals into this synaptic cleft, this spatial region between neurons. right? And those chemicals will be received by sensor or receptor sites on the dendrite, which is sort of the receiving end of another neuron body, and that the strength of the chemical concentrations and the type of chemicals that are dumped into this region are going to determine how strong the signal is that propagates from the receiving end of the neuron body down to its body. And what's going to happen is that all the signals from different dendrites, which are electrical signals, are going to come down to the neuron body. It's going to integrate all those, and if it has enough signal, it will fire and send information to the neurons it's connected to synaptically. Okay, so you can see that the strength of connection between one neuron and another is modulated by the kind and amount of chemicals that are in this synaptic cleft region. And it turns out, so here, these pink things are this rendition of glial cells. As I mentioned, they have a lot of the same receptors and chemicals that are involved in, or that the neurons have, and so they can also dump chemicals out into the synaptic cleft, which means that they can influence the chemical concentration and the types of chemicals that are in this region, and therefore influence the strength of these neuron connections, right? And so what happens is the neural activity can stimulate those calcium waves that I mentioned to you in the glial cells, and the calcium waves can also be initiated within the glial cells and cause feedback onto the neuron synapse. So there's a bidirectional coupling between these two cell types in this system.
Well, what are the green balls?
The green balls, these are just supposed to represent little chemicals.
No, I mean the big ones.
Oh, well, these are like little, what are they called? Physicist's description of these things. So this is, yeah, right, a vesicle, right, that's inside. So it's a little membrane inside the cell that is being induced to release chemicals by exocytosis.
And I have another question.
Yes.
With the electrical signals, there's supposed to be some kind of a flaw. I mean, if you think of the last speaker's talk and also things that I've read, apparently there's a flow of fluid in the axon together associated with the electric discharge, with the electric field. Did you discuss that, or will you discuss that?
No, so my segue is that, so this is a very molecular, cellular level picture of what's going on, and there are lots of neurobiologists and mathematicians and other people who are studying that scale, and I'm interested in examining a slightly higher scale, the network level, what's going on. So that's what's going on at that scale, and I'm really interested in probing the interaction of glial cells, or the effect that glial cells can have on neuronal spiking patterns, looking at networks of neurons, okay, and spatially and temporally resolving whole isolated networks of neuron activity, and quantifying the measurement and determining the effect of glial cells. So to start to introduce you to this concept, because when I show you the actual experimental system, you'll see how messy it is. I've got here a toy model, which is supposed to show you four neurons, A, B, C, and D, that are wired up or connected synaptically in some way that I've depicted here. And let's just say, for the sake of argument, that there are three different, qualitatively different firing patterns that are observed in this network. Okay, and by firing pattern, what I mean is, if neuron A fires, its voltage spikes, right? So one possibility is that neuron A voltage spikes, then B voltage spikes, then C does, then D does. And it happens in a burst of activity on the network. Network's sitting there quietly, and then all of a sudden we see A, B, C, D. Okay, and then it goes back to being quiet. And then we might see another type of burst, which is C fires, then B fires, then A and D fire together. And then I'm saying, well, let's imagine there's a third type, and that's C and D firing, and then A firing. So if we were to look at some way to look at this data, I can imagine, or what is often done, is creating what's called a raster plot. Put up all that. Okay. So they're not that easy to look at unless you've looked at a lot of them, so I'm going to walk you through this. So what we've done is we take the time series of neuron A, and we just run it along here in this first bar, and then we take neuron B, and we run its equivalent time series along here, and so on for C and D. And so we can see when A fires in relation to when B, C, and D fire, okay? So the black regions here represent times when the whole network's quiet, nothing's going on, and then the yellow is saying, well, that's when there was a voltage spike, okay? can see that we can sort of window this into regions of quiescence and regions of activity, which we call bursts, okay? And then the question is there a way that we can quantify these bursts so that, I mean, here, when I have this toy, right, I can say, well, I know A fired, then B, then C, then D, but in reality, first of all, you can't resolve this information so well if you're looking at a real network. And second of all, you can't temporally resolve it well. And then furthermore, that only gives you one piece of information about the firing, which you actually can't even get. So the question is, I'm trying to say, is there a way to quantify these different bursts that would allow us to say burst one is qualitatively different from burst three? So it's some measure. And that would allow us to be discovering or identifying representations that this network has for information, right? So burst three means it's storing some information, some input, some memory, some letter of an alphabet that has some meaning in the brain. So it's a tool, right? It's a pattern, right? That the brain uses to represent information. Okay, so that's the basic idea. And I'm gonna introduce now through a numerical model that we're building, basic idea of the system and how it's coupled into a network and how the glial cells interact with the neural network, and then I'll show you experiments. Okay, so we start with a neuron model. It is the type of Morrison Leaker, which has been used by a lot of people. And so that's how we model the neuron spiking, the voltage spikes. Okay, then we use a different model that was introduced by Sodikes to couple these neurons together synaptically. And what's different about this is what Sodikes introduced is that this synaptic strength can vary in time, right? And that's something that's been observed experimentally, so that's something we want to incorporate in our model. Oh, and I should say I'm not going to show you any equations. And that might be hard for some of you who'd like to see these equations, but I can show you them afterwards if you'd like. And then the third part of the model is a spatially extended glial cell. Okay, so it's got spatial extent and nonlinear reaction diffusion equations that model the propagation of waves. So it's a reaction diffusion model where we have nonlinear reaction and diffusion that causes, if you go above some threshold of calcium concentration, then you get a spike in the calcium concentration, and that propagates through space through a reaction diffusion process similar to like a fire propagating through a field, right? And so then we have the glial cell coupled to the neuron. So when these waves of calcium pass, that will affect the synaptic strength, okay? And when the neurons fire, depending on which neurons they are, that can also affect the synaptic strength, okay? So there's these two types of cells are coupled in this model to the synapse, okay?
Yes. So what's the relationship between the underlying finite grid and the size of the cell? Like when you solve the differential equations, you have a grid, right?
Right.
So how you put the cells onto this grid?
Okay, I'll show
and
you.
What's the size? What's the size?
Okay, so I think the answer to your question is that we couple them to each other by we lay the neural networks out in space, and I'll show you. Well, I'll show you a picture, like that, right? And we lay the extended glial cells underneath them, and then there's a synapse located halfway between every connection. And then if that synapse falls in the spatial domain of the glial cell, then we couple at a point, just a point. Okay. So the space is information is really stored just in these glial cells, right? And the reaction diffusion process occurs in the glial cells. And if one of these synaptic points feels in time a spike in calcium concentration, then something happens. Does that make sense? Okay.
Mm-hmm. I thought you mentioned at the beginning that the glial cells and the neurons are roughly of the same size. Is that true, or did I miss?
Yes, that's true.
So why are the glial cells spatially extended, whereas the neurons are?
Okay, because phenomenologically, even though morphologically, in concrete reality, these cells are about the same size, phenomenologically, of neural communication is that you have a neuron body, it reaches a threshold, it voltage spikes, and it sends a signal through an axon, right, to a far distant position. And where the neuron body is located in space has a lot less importance in determining which other neurons it can talk to than the glial cell, which is a reaction diffusion process, which means it's only local propagation of information. Does that make sense? So we feel like it's a reasonable starting point to model things this way. But if you have reason otherwise.
Well, I'm just sort of thinking that a single glial cell, if you're especially extended region, does that represent a single glial cell?
No, this is four different glial cells.
I see, so it's not.
Yeah, it's four different ones, and they can communicate with each other, but they are distinct. Yeah, and when I show you a simulation, you'll see they have distinct activity. All right, so to show you what observables we can get from this model, this just shows you a time series of voltage spiking in the model of a neuron, and this is just to remind you that this activity is distributed in space. And then here's an example of the activity of a calcium wave in a glial cell at a local fixed position. And I just want to point out to you the difference in time scales of these two signals. This is on the order of 20 milliseconds, and this is on the order of seconds. Right? So there's a separation of time scales in this information, or this communication, which might play a role. And this is just showing you a snapshot of the calcium waves in a glial cell.
Could you explain that glial calcium wave? Where does that calcium come from and where does it go?
It comes from stores within the cell.
Okay.
And then it's a complicated process, IP3 modulated process, but when the calcium concentration reaches a certain level in the cell, that causes sort of an autocatalytic feedback that causes these vesicles to open and dump more calcium very quickly into the environment, and that's the mechanism
And that goes into the surrounding environment, surrounding all the cells, is that right?
Yes, right, that goes into the extracellular space.
And what's in that space, fluid?
Yep, and extracellular fluid.
Okay, but not other glial cells.
I'll show you a picture. Hold off. And if I don't answer, then.
Yeah,
okay. All right. So here's the napkin. I'll just say a few more words. So I mentioned that we lay down these neurons, which are the balls, and the glial cells are these four glial cells are the rectangles. The green balls are excitable neurons. That means if they're connected to another neuron, their function is that they will enhance the probability that neuron will fire. The red balls represent inhibitory neurons. Those neurons, if they fire and then they communicate to the neurons they're connected to, they will increase the refractoriness of that neuron, which is its inability to fire. Do people know what refractory means? Yeah, okay. All right. So, and I just want to point out that these are directionally coupled. So just as in real neural networks, there is a direction of communication. And as I mentioned, there are synapses that are located halfway between all these connections. Oh, and then the final thing is the way we've chosen to wire these up, although this is unknown for sure how this is done, but it's a good educated guess, is that we say, okay, there are going to be on the order of 20 connections per neuron, so this neuron number one is going to communicate with roughly 20 other neurons in this system. And we just pick another neuron at random, and based on the distance between them, we ask what probability is it that these two are wired up together. And so we use a Gaussian weighting to determine the probability that they're talking to each other. Okay? And then you notice the last thing is, as a starting point, we're creating kind of a system that has topologically two subnetworks that are more highly connected with each other, and then they are more sparsely connected between each other. And you'll notice that the glial cells are lying so that most of the synapses that they are interacting with are the ones that are the sparse connections between these two subnetworks. Okay? So that's a way we hope to probe the effect of the glial activity on these two networks. Okay. So now I'm going to show you a simulation that's done on this network that I just showed you. And I don't know if you can see, these little gray dots represent the positions of the neurons, and this faint red box represents those four glial cells, and you'll see bursts of light. Hopefully, yeah. And those represent the neuron voltage spiking. And you'll see waves of calcium concentration in the glial cells that are sometimes initiated by the activity of the neurons and sometimes by just noise. And I want you to point out that, so these little flashes that you see are bursts of activity in the neuron, neural network.
It seems to me that sometimes just like one or two neuron clusters can have a huge propagation of the wave. But sometimes you have a bunch of, you know, like group of neurons, and they didn't actually elicit that kind of like diffusion, you know, reaction stuff. So I'm just wondering, does that make sense?
That's a good question. That's really what we're trying to investigate. So it's good that you asked. Tell you what exactly it is we're trying to understand. So the question you just asked, what role do the glial cells play in, if any, in these bursting patterns that are stored, if you will, or observed in these neural networks, right? Do they have any effect or not? Okay, and that's the basic question. And the way we're trying to come at it, the reason we've designed simulation in this case with these two subnetworks connected sparsely is because we're interested in the hypothesis that maybe we would be able to see synchrony or something between these two networks that are desynchronized by the activity that occurs here, or we might see that these become more synchronous because of the activity here. Is some way to get at that question. And that's the question of how to quantify these bursts too, because how do we quantify them so that we can say, okay, we saw quantification measure A before the bursting activity, and then it turned to the measure B after, right? Rather than just some fuzzy, oh, it looks different, right? Okay. So that's where after. And, okay, you can see that, I mean, this is pretty complicated, right? But it's nice and controlled, and we know every single connection, right? And we know among neurons, and we know where the neurons connected to the glial cells. Here's the real sample, okay? So you can see that it's a lot more complicated. Now, these coexist in space, but they've just been dyed with different dyes that absorb the different cell types, so you can see them. So this is the neural network in a culture sample, and I'll describe in a second how that's formed. And then this is the corresponding glial cells, okay? And you can see that here's like a neuron body, for example, and all these stringy things that come off are the axons and dendrites, the processes of this neural body that are wiring up and connecting to other neurons through synapses. And here with the glial cells, you can see that some of them also have these sort of long processes, more extended protrusions, but they also have these broad areas where they're flatter, okay? And this is the reaction diffusion waves of calcium. I'll show you some movies that where they propagate through these kinds of areas and in the skinny areas, okay? And then to show you, this is what sample really looks like, right? It's an interwovenness of these two cell types, okay? So you can think of it as a network of glial activity, which is reaction diffusion waves, and a network of neurons, which are these neurons firing and communicating with each other electrically. And then what you have are two coupled, bidirectionally coupled networks, which have activity on these two different time scales, okay? All right, so yeah, so I think it's kind of interesting to understand how these samples are made. So these are what are called cultured neurons. And what you do is you take, and we don't do this, we have biology friends who do this more than us, but you take a rat and you dissect its brain and you centrifuge it, so you get the cells that are in this little rat baby brain out, and they're little seed cells. And so they're completely dissociated from each other. And isolated. And then you throw them down in a dish, so you have a sticky surface that cells like to grow on, and you throw a bunch of cells down on the order of 100,000 on a 5 millimeter square-ish size. And then you can't separate the glial cells from the neurons because they're both tiny, just tiny little seeds. And then they'll grow over a period of weeks. The samples we look at tend to be about 3 to 6 weeks old, and they will send out these processes and find each other and connect up, okay? then they wire up in some way, and after this period of time, they start to exhibit spontaneous activity. So you'll see both calcium waves in the glial cells, and you'll see neurons burst.
Is it thinking?
Well, you know, there's a guy at Georgia Tech who has cultures in dishes, and he has some feedback at the computer, and he claims that the dish learns. And he has some, you know, story that sounds... it gets off the table and walks away, yeah.
He needs to get a body.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's, yeah, that's why I like to mention it. It's very provocative how they just wire up, right? You think, well, it's random. And in an actual functioning brain, right, there's a lot of information that's in there that's telling perhaps which neurons to wire up to what. And there's a lot of structure in the brain, actually. So
what are the other structural components? I mean, do we have, you know, the extracellular matrix here? Do we have, you know, the proteins on it?
Right. So we're in a nutrient broth, which is just some, you know, bunch of proteins and so forth that the cells need to grow. And then there's
some serum,
exactly. And then there are these glial cells, right? And we know that neurons can't grow without these glial cells. And they actually secrete, like, what we call glial juice in our, right, untechnical way. And it needs to be there. These cells have to be there in a high enough concentration that there's enough glial juice around that these guys stay happy, otherwise they die. And that's actually an issue that comes in when you try to grow these things in closed channel devices.
When you mentioned that they grow, they don't actually divide, right?
Nope.
They're just, so it's the same number of cells you started with, they just mature and
right.
Yeah.
Get bigger, just extend processes and connect, yeah. Yep. Okay, so that's the sample. Starting point in the sample, and then how do we look at it, okay? So you're looking at static snapshot pictures, right? And we're interested in the spatiotemporal dynamics in these couple networks, right? So the way we get at that is we load these cells with calcium-sensitive dyes that are going to tell us the concentration of calcium in the glial cells, which we know is interesting information because I told you that the activity in glial cells is changes in concentration of calcium. It's also going to give us information about neuron spiking because the electrical activity in neurons is coupled to changes in calcium concentration. That's part of the mechanism of the electrochemical activity of neurons, actually. So we can simultaneously monitor the activity on the neural network and in the glial network looking at the calcium. Okay. So I want to stress what I see as perhaps the important properties of the system that are going to give rise to interesting and differentiable dynamics in the system. So as I mentioned, remember the neural network has a fast time scale on the order of milliseconds in which information propagates, and the glial cells have a slow time scale. It's on the order of seconds to tens of seconds for signal propagation. So the interaction of these two networks represents an interaction of two time scales. And so one thing we're interested in is the separation of, this was supposed to be me telling you the properties of the system, and then I was supposed to tell you the goals, and I'm mixing the two, sorry, not being organized. So these are the properties which I mentioned, and then our objectives are to first of all be able to collect information about all the activity from all the cells in isolated networks, in whole networks. So up to this point, neurobiologists have been able to stick electrodes in individual cells and look at the activity with great time resolution, but only at a certain locations or a certain number of cells, so they can't look at the whole network at once. And then a few people have managed or are looking at using imaging whole networks, but they're asking different questions. So what we'd like to do is look at networks on the order of tens to thousands of cells and look at both the glial activity and the neural activity simultaneously and try to find ways to quantify that activity that we see there.
I don't understand. 50 microns per millisecond, 50 microns per millisecond. Is that the pulse propagation
yes,
speed?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Sorry, yeah. And then this is the wave propagation speed of the LCM. Yeah. Yes?
How do you separate the output of the, as you said,
they have different time scales. So if, so the pictures that I showed, you can imagine if we're taking movies, some pixels will have a neuron body standing on it, and we'll see calcium changes on the order of milliseconds of fast spiking. And then other pixels will have the slow dynamic, and so we can just assign, okay, that's glial activity, and the other pixels representing neural activity. And for the resolution that we have right now, one body is about one pixel size. There are cases where sometimes, and oh, and I should say, these samples, one sec, are really flat. They're one cell body thick for the most part, maybe two sometimes. What? And you'd have to do a lot of work to get real quantitative information about the actual intensities here. So we just say, did an event happen or not? We don't ask the degree of the event. Okay, so now I'm going to show you our various attempts at this. And so one of the big objectives, right, is to look at whole networks at once. And that might sound simple to you, but it's really not. And so we've been doing some learning about how to do this. And so what you're looking at here is an example of one type of way to try to look at the whole network at once. So what you're looking at here is all this black region, and we sprayed down some chemical that the cells don't like to grow on. And then we put a little sticky drop of chemical that the neurons and glial cells do like to grow on. And that confines all the cells that we dropped down, those seed cells, to grow only in the sticky spot. And then the other ones just die. And so I want to show you a series of images that look similar to this. They're static snapshots to show you the variations that you can get when you lay down networks this way. Okay, and you can see it's kind of hard to tell the difference between glial cells and neurons in these pictures, right? I mean, you can see there's sort of heterogeneity in how these cells lay themselves down in terms of density and so forth. And what you're looking at here is just that after we took dynamic data, we let the sample dry out, and this is just the fluorescence signal. Okay. So, yeah, I'm just going to show you a series of images so you can look at them. You can see, I think they're kind of pretty. more in a, you know, appreciate it kind of way, as in just trying to deal with it kind of way.
Labels both the neurons and the glial cells?
Yes. Mm-hmm. All right. So now you can see kind of a mess, very difficult to know what's connected to what and even what cell type is what. And so our next attempt was to try to constrain these networks somewhat by laying them down instead of just a little droplet in a more ordered environment. So again, it's the same basic idea, only this time we kind of lay down the sticky stuff the cells like to grow on everywhere, and then we stamp on top of that regions where with something that the cells don't like to grow on. And to give you a sense of scale, these chambers are 1 millimeter square, and this is 1 millimeter long, and this is, I think, 20 microns across. And then we do the same thing, seed the cells, and then we get a mixture of neurons and glial cells. And this is our attempt to try to get at that idea of subnetworks that I showed you in the model, where we have a network here, for example, and a network here, and then they can connect, hopefully, through these bridges. And what we've learned is that, based on the results we've gotten so far, 1 millimeter long is too far. And these guys aren't generally able to connect, so we're starting to do experiments now. We're trying to make show you a few blow-ups. So here's one region of that sample I just showed you, so you can see the glia and the neurons in this device and how they're starting to send their processes down. So this is a glass substrate, and we have a PDMS surface, and we spin coat that with the polymer, and then we just, and it's preferential, like what the molecule that single molecular preferential likes to stick on.
So you can have those things be a pattern you want.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we etch, so we can. It's kind of like how people make the microfluidic devices, that's how we make the scans.
Do the cells actually locomote into those spaces, or do they grow into those spaces?
Well, then you get philosophical, I think. The my understanding, which isn't necessarily authoritative, but there are a number of different signals to which neurons respond to, and it makes sense actually because that's what we use to sense light, and what we use neurons to sense touch, right? And we use neurons to smell and so forth. And so they are receptive to light, and the neurons will grow processes out toward light, and they will respond to touch, right? They will move toward if you touch them. So there are multiple ways that you can encourage neural growth, but it's a very slow time scale. And I think if you're asking how do we get this to happen, I think it's genes. It's, you know, they would grow here, but they don't like it, so they just grow here. They're just spreading. It's their nature to want to just spread out and explore space. Okay. Yeah, I mean, these methods I'm talking about, people have demonstrated that they work, but it wouldn't be practical to try to grow a whole network by coaxing each neuron where you want it to go. So we rely on sort of random processes within a constrained environment that we've drawn out. Here's just another example of neurons and glial cells growing in a sample like this. And this is another example of different kinds of stamping. So this is we stamped down a hexagonal pattern, and just by chance, in one of the samples, more glial cells grew, and in another sample, more neurons grew. And you can see that there are a couple neuron bodies in that predominantly glial sample, but so you can see that we can control the wiring to some degree in these samples, and also the kind of cells that predominate by chance. You can get one type or the other. So you can imagine growing samples like these and then using them to look at the behavior of what's going on in this kind of pattern, and then try to figure out a way to get these sandwiched together or something, for example, and then look at the effect that glial cells have on that network's firing. And there are just more examples showing that we're okay successful in getting the neurons to grow.
Question, in the case where you just have the neurons,
mm-hmm.
how are they supported by the other cells if they're essential for them to grow?
So they're in a media where some of the other wells that are sharing the same bath have lots of glial cells in them.
So as long as they're touching or close to some of the cells in some part of their cell body.
Well, and they don't even have to necessarily touch. They just have to have that glial juice. They have to have access to, in their broth. So that's one question. You know, when you design a microfluidic device, a closed device, how can you make sure that there's enough of this, the glial cells around, for example, that you can study neural processes and have them happy and healthy? Okay. So here is just another example of one of these kinds of samples. I'm going to show you a movie from it. That's why I want to show you the snapshot. So you can see that there are about three different networks. I mean, this one's pretty tiny, but there's a little network that developed there. And that actually, in this case, it does look like the cells managed to proliferate all the way through the bridge. And this is the same scale. This is 1 millimeter and 1 millimeter. So now I'm going to show you, and there's a lot that goes on with this little cluster of neurons here, and you're going to see the movie should have, so you'll see bursts of neural activity, and then the slower, like this stuff here, are like that's a glial wave. Can you see, by the way?
Yeah.
glial activity here. Hopefully it again, wait.
Sorry, how fast was your camera?
Oops, yeah, so the camera speed, so I'm showing you something that's on the order of 20 frames a minute. This is, blah. This movie is playing 15 times actual speed. Your question might be, because why, if neurons are firing under 20 milliseconds, why can we see this bursting? And the reason is because the types of samples we have happen to be the kind where this is time and this is voltage. When the neuron goes above threshold, we see what happens is that it goes above, and then we see like a whole string of bursting before the neurons go back down to their rest state. So we don't get just a single spike. We get multiple spike activity. All right, so I don't know why.
Are you going to play that?
I want to play this again, but for some reason, you know, what happens to this? Here, I'm going to blow up this region here. And I think in the blow up, you'll be able to see the neural network spiking and the glial activity a little more clearly. So pay attention to this area. So that you see that lightning neural network lighting up and the burst, 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 and then these glial waves. And you can see how the glial waves in that neural network could be interacting.
Are they firing on their own, or are you stimulating them?
No, so this is spontaneous activity. We do enhance it by putting it in a magnesium changed magnesium environment, but it does exhibit to get more activity, but does exhibit activity on its own. And we also sometimes do experiments where we stimulate with an electrode.
Does it require glucose?
The process requires glucose?
Yeah.
That's a good question. I don't know if there's sugar in the medium actually. There's ATP processes going on, so I would guess.
How is their firing converted into light though? I mean, you're using a camera to do this, right? I mean,
right.
Just naturally.
It's calcium sensitive fluorescence. Yeah, so there's a calcium sensitive dye, and when an axon fires, there's calcium released, and so we see that, and then the glial activity is changes in calcium concentration, so that's monitored with the dye also. Okay, so now here's the embarrassing part. So this is, after all those really sophisticated devices that we saw this morning, this is ours, an example of one, and we're not even really able to use it yet, okay? This is so I feel silly showing you this because you guys don't need to see this. But this is our basic idea, right? That everything I showed you before was just stamped on a flat surface, right? So we're able to get these neurons and glial cells to grow on the flat surface, but we'd like to eventually be able to grow them in closed channel devices. And I'll talk about why that might be useful in a moment. And as you saw, the way we lay down the samples, these things are designed, so I showed you these well-like examples where you have whole networks of neurons growing and then connected by a few processes. We've also liked to design wells where they're big enough for only a few cell bodies to fit, and then the processes would be constrained to grow in the channels, and that would give us a more controlled network. And so that's what I'm trying to show here, is that if we do that, then we're going to have situations where some of the wells will have glia only, and some of them will have neurons and glial cells, and some of them will have just neurons. And so we'd have some network connected up where we could monitor maybe what's going on with a bunch of glia talking to a bunch of neurons, for example. Okay, so in the types of questions that we're interested in addressing, there are some advantages to using microfluidic devices, and I think one thing in particular which we could probe, which would be really interesting and accessible using that kind of technology. So one is, I've showed you, right, you can grow those islands, but this type of technology would allow us to have much better experimental control over the topology and connectivity of these networks. It also would allow us to control locally the chemical concentrations, right, in space. So be able to, like, for example, shoot in a little extra neurotransmitter at some low information and then measure how that affects the network activity. Or conversely, to sample locally, right? See what concentrations are naturally at localized positions. And that's interesting to me because I think in the long run, an interesting question is, in these networks, there are local effects and global effects. And it's interesting, can local effects, like changes in synaptic strength at a given synapse, have global repercussions in the whole network? Or does it just affect things locally, for example? Or does a local effect, for example, in these stamp solutions, right? Stamp samples, we have them, like I said, submerged in this bath of media. And we could change the environment of the whole network by changing the bath, right? That would be a global change that the whole network would feel. And I'm interested in contrasting that kind of change to the network to applying a local change and seeing, does that have a different kind of effect on the network dynamics than applying a global change to the system? And from a pattern formation point of view, that's interesting to me, local versus global competition and the resulting pattern. Again, tying pattern formation to potentially, that's the way the system stores information, that's the way our brain thinks, that's a function. Yes?
Wouldn't that make a big difference, like which neuron, in the real system, which neuron you shut off?
Yeah, you mean, what do you mean, like?
Well, in the sense that you say some local thing has a global impact that depends very much what local is. In the
right.
sense that if you shut down a half on airport, it's not going to affect very much of the US air travel, but if you shut down LAX.
So, being able to, and anybody who knows much about neurons knows that even constraining them the way we are, there's still a lot of connectivity that we don't know about. Because any neuron body has hundreds of thousands of synapses, right? So, they're really connected up in a complicated way. And you're right, shutting off one that's not very connected will have very little effect compared to one that's very globally connected. But, and those are the kinds of questions people ask. But I think it's interesting in a real system, right, which is vastly more complex than what I think has been studied so far, what are those global versus local implications? This is a really different topology than I think what we've imagined so far in networks. I might be wrong, but I think, you know, it's analog, first of all, right? I mean, like I mentioned, there's varying strengths at all those different synapses. So not only is it's not just an on-off thing, or am I connected or am I not connected, right? Anyway, I'm babbling. You get the idea. All right. And so, you know, I think over the course of this workshop, I'm going to learn many more challenges involved in trying to deal with these samples and microfluidic devices. But one of them, the first one, is it's really hard to keep the cells going in there and have them living, let alone healthy. All right, so I'm going to close with just showing you one of the ways that we have been approaching trying to quantify the dynamics that we observe in these systems, because that's a whole other angle that's really important at getting at this problem at this level. So the ultimate objective is to try to find a measure, a quantitative measure, that will allow us to distinguish these birth types, or ultimately to be able to compare the network activity before glial events and after, right? And be able to tell that there's a difference, so that indicates that the glial cells are actually having an effect on the patterns that the neural network stores. Okay, so one approach we've taken is to look at the changes of the correlation of neurons within a neural network firing, okay? I'm going to just use a cartoon to describe it. So you can imagine that there's some network that has a bunch of neurons in it, but we're looking at neuron 1 and neuron 7, which happen to be synaptically connected, and their synapse happens to lie in the vicinity of a glial cell. Okay? And so you could imagine the situation where when there's bursts of activity in this network that we're interested in, neuron 1 and neuron 7 happen to fire together. Okay? So they're highly correlated. And then the question is, what happens when glial activity modulates the synaptic strength here? Well, you could imagine that one thing that could happen is that could cause a decorrelation in the firing of these two neurons, okay? it could weaken their connection or something, and then neuron 1 fires and neuron 7 doesn't, or vice versa. Another scenario you can imagine is that it starts out where neuron 1 and neuron 7 aren't very synchronous or not highly correlated in their activity, and that the effect of the glial cell is that it makes them more highly correlated, right? So this is just a proposal of one of the ways that you could imagine glial cells interacting with this neural network through these synaptic connections and causing effect, something we could look for, hope to measure, okay? Because we're kind of stabbing around in the dark here to some degree. All right, so to look for these correlations in these pairs of neurons, like neuron 1 and 7 that I described, we're going to use these raster plots that I mentioned before. So to get you oriented about what the data is, so we have, I showed you the movie, right, where there's all that black space where nothing is happening, so we throw out all that information. We don't want to analyze dead space, right? And then we keep all the pixels where there's activity, okay? And we separate out neural activity and glial activity by using the time scales. And then we plot pixels that represent neural activity, so the right time scale activity, in a raster plot where this is neuron number one that we've extracted from our data, this is the second neuron, the third neuron, and so on. And this is its time series. Okay? And this is just over a window, and everything that's white here represents time where nothing is happening, the network is quiescent, and then here's the next burst, and it's hard to tell, but if you look closely, these actually are different. And so we've got all the active neurons, 1 through N, and their burst, local bursting activity in time. Okay? And what we're interested in is how correlated is neuron 1's activity with every other neuron in this burst. And then in relation to that, in terms of glial activity, but I'm getting ahead of myself. So first we want to ask the question, how correlated is this neuron's activity with all the other neurons in the network, as measured by looking at within a burst, okay? So we take one burst, and then this is the same burst, so we're going to compare neuron 1's activity to itself, and then to every other neuron in the system, and take the correlation function and plot that correlation function in a matrix. So the diagonal elements will be the neuron compared to itself, so the correlation of all of the whole diagonal will be 1. And then this is, of course, symmetric matrix, and so in this top half, say, is all the information about the correlation of every neuron with every other neuron in the network. Okay, and this is just showing that we do this for every burst separately. Now what we're really interested in is, the effect of glial activity on this these correlations, right? So what we do is we compare the correlation matrices that happen for bursting dynamics before a glial event and after a glial event. So here's showing two different waves passing in the same glial cell at different times. And we just take a window, time window, which is just an educated guess of about plus or minus 30 seconds in this case, and then we plot in time where every burst happened the correlation matrix for that burst. Okay, and then what we do is we average all of the correlation bursts of the bursts that happened before glial events, and that we average all the correlation matrices of the activity after the events, and then we take the difference between them. Okay? And so then we are left with a matrix that gives the average correlation difference for every pair of neurons in the system. And then so you can see that in this case, no difference is black, and color represents either an increase in correlation or a decrease in correlation between neuron pairs. And then the issue becomes, because there are going to be differences just randomly, right, which of these are statistically significant? Okay. So there are ways that statisticians and neurobiologists deal with this, and this is something, to me as a physicist, this gets really messy and makes me uncomfortable, but this seems to be the state of things right now. We're really trying to play around with this data and extract something meaningful from it. But what we do is we say, okay, we need to determine which of these differences in correlation between neurons that we've measured are perhaps meaningful and represent the glial waves doing something and making an actual change in the bursting activity and the correlation in neuron pairs, and which are just happen because random chance would allow that there's a high probability that they would happen. So what we do is we take all of the bursts that we collect, and this is just an illustrative subset, and we take the time series for neuron 1 at every burst, and we shuffle it. So the activity that's exhibited by neuron 1 is shuffled among all the different burst events that we observed. And we do that for every neuron in the network, and we do this 2,000 times. And we do the same analysis on those shuffled bursts as we did on the original bursts. Okay? And then we generate a distribution function of all the average differences in correlation of those randomized bursts and compare it to the supposedly meaningful bursts, right? And we ask, which of those are statistically significant, and by that we mean which of them do we fall within the 98% confidence limit. Okay, so they are events that are very unlikely to happen, and so because we see them, we assume that maybe they're statistically significant, although they could just be improbable events happening. Right. So we do that, and then we subtract out all of the events that don't pass that test, okay, from our correlation matrix, and then we're left with these black dots represent things that didn't pass, and then all the colored dots represent things that either became more correlated, pairs of neurons that became more correlated or less correlated in the activity as a function of the glial wave passing. Okay? So it seems like there are some neurons that are either becoming more or less correlated as a function of that glial activity. Although you look at these and you see that, we know that these rows and columns correspond to a particular neuron, and it looks like there's some structure, right, that are lines. And so maybe there's an alternative explanation to why some of these neurons pass this test. It's not because necessarily the correlation of that neuron and other neurons has become strengthened, but perhaps instead because this neuron is just firing more or less often, right, individually, independent of what it's coupled. So we did the same analysis, but this time just looking at individual neurons and asking, did its firing probability change before and after a glial event? Okay. And things that are showing up in color here represent neurons where the firing activity did change, okay, as a response to the glial event. So bad news is it seems like a lot of these events are not because of changing in the correlation because of glial activity, but because of changing in firing rate. But this firing rate change is still correlated with glial activity. So the glial waves are doing something significant to some of these neurons. They're changing the individual firing behavior of neurons rather than pair strength changes with glial activity. So this suggests two different mechanisms that we've observed within a network for glial activity on these neural networks, and these are consistent with what neurobiologists have measured in single cells. Okay, so that is good. And so in summary, I hope that I've introduced to you what you find an interesting system of coupled neural networks and glial networks, and explain to you the potential that this separation of time scales could have in encoding information in neural networks that could open up a whole spectrum of encoding that wouldn't be accessible to just neural networks if they weren't interacting with glial networks. And we're trying to use simulations and experiments to simultaneously probe these questions at the network level, and as I say, this is kind of embarrassing, but eventually we'd like to